Welcome to the Wonder Woman podcast, where we discuss a variety of subjects all pertaining to optimizing your physique, building strength, developing a strong mindset, and tools to help you win at life. I'm Michelle McDonald, and I'm the founder of the Wonder Woman Coaching Team. We are a community of results-driven coaches and clients who believe that we can age like never before. All right, welcome to the show. So today I have a very special guest. I'm so excited to introduce you to Victoria Felkar. I hope I said that right. And Victoria just got back from a Swiss conference. So if you don't know what that is, it's the Society of Weightlifting and Injury Specialists. It's a big conference. I've been to one in the past myself. This year it was in Ohio. And she delivered us a seminar that was standing room only. That's how, current her information is, and people want to hear it. There's a huge gap in our knowledge base, and we need people like Victoria to tell us what's going on and what's current. So Victoria, she's a doctoral researcher. She conducts interdisciplinary studies on women's health, reproductive function, and pharmaceutical steroid hormones. And I think, you know, one of the reasons I really want to have her on this podcast is because, you know, she started out as an athlete herself. She worked with a very famous coach, John Meadows, and she was herself in such, a poor hormonal state that John went and sent her to his doctor, Dr. Eric Serrano, who actually just gave her an award at this conference, which is amazing. And Serrano became a mentor figure for her. Am I right in saying that?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so, you know, our audience, people that love the Wonder Woman and what we're about, they are athletes themselves. We're athletes. We're women who maybe later in life or maybe in your 20s and 30s have decided that you want more from health and fitness. And we've completely left diet culture and we want to be athletes. We train like athletes. We eat like athletes. We think about going to sleep before a deadlift training session, right? And we really are interested in optimizing how we age. So we don't just want to survive the aging process, but we want to know, we want to stay current with what the evidence is for aging optimally. So I'm really excited to have Victoria here, and we're gonna talk a lot about all things hormones. So guys, make sure you grab your notepad, take some notes, and we're gonna just start diving in. Thanks, Victoria. So first off, there is a huge, it seems like a huge gap in knowledge with GPs, general practitioners, and with women around just how complex female hormones are and their reproductive life cycle. And I know this is a really important entry point for you, Victoria. So if you could share a little bit of background and history on HRT and, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be back, and also just to be in such a progressive group. I think one of the first things I really need to establish with your listeners is that women's health is, our knowledge pool is definitely, there's a lag compared to men's health. And then when we look at the athletic population, female athlete health, there's a lag behind the male athletic population. And then the aging female population is even further behind. And so the women that are listening to this, you guys are the transgressors. You are literally at the cusp entry. And so there is going to be a knowledge gap. I always jokingly say that when we have the conversation about reproductive function or even just pharmaceutical steroids, that it's really important to remember that in order for me to have these conversations within the female population, I first had to learn the science behind the male population, because that's all I was exposed to in school initially. It wasn't that it was a, you know, gendered lens we were looking at it. Not at all. And I would argue that although knowledge has come a long way, we're still very much behind. And as women have had more entry into sports, and particularly strength sports, the numbers of participants far exceeds our knowledge level, which our knowledge, our research exceeds what's happening in the clinical room, in your doctor's office. So there is a very, very big knowledge disparity. I don't know if we're ever going to be at a point where that's going to catch up, I'm not holding my
You're gonna
breath
push.
because I'm not holding my breath because I look at even with the male athletic population, just that there is some disparities there. But what we can kind of take away from all this is that I think that already starts to provide a really important lens that when you go into your doctor's office, just remember that, hey, I am ahead of the curve in a big way. And that's why it's so important to educate yourself. So thank you for giving the women this opportunity to do so. So where are we going to start? We're going to start with talking about the history of hormones a little bit, which is one of my favorite subjects. Absolutely. And I think, it's context. Context is queen. When we can understand some of the history, it then helps us navigate this very confusing landscape. So I think one of the very first places to start is, what are we actually talking about? We're talking about steroid hormones. Now, initially,
And let's explain what that is, because people are going to think steroids, but they don't understand, like,
absolutely.
estrogen is a steroidal hormone.
Absolutely. So all it means is that we're dealing with a biochemical that has a cholesterol backbone. So cholesterol is the backbone to steroid hormones. And we're not just talking about androgens or estrogens or progesterones. We're also talking about glucocorticoids and mineral corticoids. So, for example, when you go to a doctor to get, say, a cortisone shot, that cortisone shot is a steroid hormone. There are many different types of steroid hormones. They work in many different ways. There's a lot of synergies between them, and we can start to build it up from there. But at its very basis, these molecules share the same backbone. And there are some similarities between some of the mechanisms involved. But just going back to, I think the history can start to tease this apart a little bit more. So steroids, the whole concept of hormones, it's a relatively new phenomenon. And so it was only 1905 that that term hormone came into existence. So that's someone, when we think about that, that's not that long ago. Before that idea came into existence, the way in which medicine functioned was, looked at the bodies of men versus women. And the main thing that was used to separate male and female bodies was anatomy. So initially it was like, okay, well, men have penises and testes, women don't. But when we do certain types of actual anatomy studies, we can see that they have internal organs that look different. They have breasts and breast tissue, they have ovaries, and that became this distinguishing feature. From there, it was why, like, what else is going on here? And so the chemical model of essentially human physiology came into existence in about the 1800s and a little bit into the 1900s. And that was where they started to say, like, you know what? I think the testes and the ovaries are the seed of masculinity and femininity. I think these are the sources of whatever these chemicals are. And they started doing some studies on that. Some of the very, very early studies were essentially taking actually dried gerbil testes and injecting them to be able to be a source of what they thought was the male hormone, even though they didn't call it back then. So they're already starting to kind of utilize this idea of injecting some type of medicine or pharmaceutical with some type of kind of sexual organ to create an outcome. And back then, the outcome that they were testing for men. It was they wanted to get them more energy and have more virility and just overall vitality. So the conversation around men, even before we had the word hormone and testosterone and androgen, it was about creating a better man, essentially. For women, however, it was to treat sickness and illness. Already at that turn of the 20th century, there were very strong attitudes and ideas around menstruation and pregnancy and the menopause, the transition. And so the hormones, the precursors, there were glandulars that were used, were to try to make the sickly woman less sickly. So it was a very different
Interesting.
narrative right from the get-go, right from the beginning. And that kind of dividing line within medicine, I would argue, still exists today, particularly when we're talking about steroid hormones and pharmacology, and also just optimizing the body as we age, as we go through time. And that, when we think about HRT for women, it's usually symptom reduction Whereas for men in andropause, it's more about energy and vitality and maintaining muscle mass. So there's already this, like, this conversation is still there today. So, let's fast forward a little bit into the 1920s. And so in the 1920s, they were able to isolate that there were these hormones. Again, still, this was all brand new, but they were able to isolate them, and they started to do some research on them. And all of this was funded by the pharmaceutical companies. And so the connection between clinicians and researchers and pharmaceutical companies within the world of steroid hormones, it's always existed. It has always been there. But because this was a new profession, so endocrinology, literally, this is the golden age. It was the brand new. What they did to try to gain some sense of esteem within the both academic and clinical world was they branched with gynecologists, because gynecologists were considered to be the elite practitioners. They were the top of the top. It was a very old and already established discipline. So endocrinologists partnered with them, and they said, "Hey, we have something that can help you with women's messy periods and problematic aging, and all of those really tough stereotypes that still exist today." And so they just started doing a ton of research on hormones. So estrogens were initially kind of like that first hormone that was synthesized. And within 1 year, it went from just being used to treat menstrual disorders to being used to treat everything under the sun. So menopause and mood disorders and skin issues and height, I mean, short height. I mean, it was, or tall height, used to close growth plates. So it was used for so many different things already. And it was this very broad net that was casted, even though these drugs had just been created. We're not taught, there was no clinical trials at the time. There was no ethics that had to be gone through. None of that existed at all. Literally, the pharmaceutical companies were giving clinicians drugs and saying, like, "Hey, go try them out on
And
your
what about the
patients."
dosage? And what was the
Anything
form?
went. Anything went. And the dosage isn't even equivalent to what we have today. They use different units. So when you go back and you try to read these early studies, you're like, "Huh." I have to say, they use something called mouse units. It took me a long time to learn the conversion for mouse units. But it was a different language that was used. And even the words they used, there was not a standardized language. It's not like all the practitioners within kind of the Western medical world were calling these drugs estrogens. Not at all. That didn't come into the 30s. They called them ovarian hormones, follicular hormones, the seed of women, feminine hormones, female sex. Like, there were so many different names. And I know to listeners, this probably sounds confusing, because it was. Like, at the end of the day, it was incredibly confusing. There was no standard at all. And that, I would argue, is still today.
I was just going to say it kind of
Still not a
sounds like what's going
standard.
on today.
Absolutely. And I think it's an important, like, lesson to understand is that we've never had standard. We've never had standard units for measuring ways in which we test even just endogenous or natural production of hormones, how they've been prescribed. None of that is standard. But back in the 1930s, because this was such an incredibly important time, essentially the powers that be around the world realized that, like, "Hey, we should try to standardize things." So they did get together, and they had this big conference, Chris. And at the time, they truly believed that only women had ovarian hormones, which was estrogens and to a lesser extent progesterone, and only men had androgens. And so they called them the male hormone and the female hormone. And they were seen to be sex exclusive, that women did not have androgens and men did not have estrogens or progesterone. And when they had the standardizing meeting, they agreed that they would call them these terms. So androus, meaning men, estrus, female, progesterone, pregnancy. So you look at those precursor names, and they are sex specific. Now, the same year that conference came out, and this was really put on by some of the pharmaceutical heads, researchers were going, like, wait, we were wrong. We found the hormones in the opposite sexes. We were wrong, but it was too late. Those drugs had already been put out to market. That dialogue had already been created in marketing. And so we're still paying for that today. When you go into your doctor's office, you are still seeing the remnants of this today. When you see medical textbooks, it still exists today. This very, very bad mistake that was tried to be course corrected right away is still plaguing us today. So much so that certain research can't be completed. So, for example, studying androgens within the female population is still an incredibly difficult thing to push through ethics because there are people that still believe women don't have androgens naturally. They don't recognize that women have more
Even at the higher
androgens.
level?
Yeah, exactly. Then estrogens. So if you look at the science, and that's what I try to do, is I try to strip away all of this noise. I try to strip away the social names that we've given to them, the ideas that have been applied over time, and look at what am I looking at here? And so that's why I choose to use the terminology like steroid hormone, because in my mind, I'm like, I'm calling it what it is, and that's that molecular backbone that it shares. I also use the term estrogens, so with an S on the end, because there's more than one. And if we don't use the right language, there are repercussions for the research. There are repercussions for prescribing, and then also for women themselves being able to advocate, because there are these nuances, there are these differences. But from the beginning, Michelle, they have been lost. They have been completely lost. And it is so sad because when we look at some of the different challenges that have existed with hormone therapy and trials, and especially, I mean, the Women's Health Initiative, it was an issue of language. It
I didn't know
really, that's what
that.
it comes down to.
So based on that, why do you think there's so much misinformation about HRT for perimenopause and menopause, right?
So, because there's always been, I know that's a really crummy answer, but the reality is there's always been a lot of misinformation. When we think about perimenopause and into menopause, even the name isn't clear cut. You still have a lot of clinicians that follow kind of the old dogma about what is menopause, what is perimenopause. Some doctors don't even talk about perimenopause because there that standardized knowledge doesn't exist. So it doesn't exist when we're just talking about these physiological states, and then it doesn't exist when we're talking about the drugs themselves. So things, wires get crossed. I often use the example in my research of like the game of telephone, where one person will share the secret and it gets lost, and by the time 75 plus years later, the discussion's not even remotely similar to what it used to be. I think another big thing that's really important to remember is that when we talk about perimenopause and menopause, there are two different kind of broad physiological effects happening. One, we have reproductive aging. Two, we have biological aging. And so reproductive aging, I use that phrase, and the research also says from that itself, is that it's the follicles and the reproductive organs themselves aging. And then biological age is it's the rest of the physiological body aging. And that those two things, they are not the same thing. Women's reproductive systems can age faster than their biological systems. And so that is a piece that often gets forgotten. There's the perception that just because I am aging, I am automatically also, succumb to my reproductive organs aging and ovaries
Wow,
shrinking and all
I
that other
love that you mentioned this. And
nonsense.
then what about, chronological aging and biological aging? Because
Yeah,
do
they're two
you
different things.
exactly. And then is it common that you have someone that, biologically is not aging the way their chronology is, but they still have early reproductive aging?
Absolutely. So I see a lot within the work. So I do a lot of translational work with clinicians and clinics. And one of the things I see a lot within the athletic population is that when not properly facilitated through diet and exercise and recovery and all of that stuff, that the reproductive aging can be expedited. And so you can see somebody in their 30s already having reproductive aging that is far more advanced than we should see for their biological age and their chronological age. And that is problematic because that means that we're not getting exposure to hormones that we should be having at that age. And when I talk about biological aging and reproductive aging, so one of the important things for reproductive aging is follicles. And follicles, so the tiny little eggs within our ovaries. Those are an incredibly important marker of female physiology, female health, because we are making so much of our steroid hormone production, specifically androgens, estrogens, and progesterone from our follicles. And if we
In our
don't have healthy
reproductive years,
follicles,
yeah.
exactly, if we don't have them, then we're not getting exposure. We're also not getting this beautiful serendipity that has in our peripheral tissues. And then we're also not being able to set ourselves up for healthy biological aging. And that
I
is
think this
really
is
the thing I
important
find a lot.
because this is going to be a bit, this is where the complexity, I mean, we've got complexity upon complexity upon complexity, and we do want to give some really useful information to the audience here.
Absolutely.
So I think let's go back a little bit. So follicular, the follicles, their cycle. I just briefly read what you presented at the Swiss conference, and I believe what you had suggested is that they're somewhat plastic in the sense that you can introduce certain things that can even reverse some reproductive aging that has happened in terms of follicular health and your follicular cycle. And of course, there's things that you should avoid doing. And there are things that a lot of athletes do because they're focused on performance and they're making maybe some bad correlations between what behaviors will facilitate that and maybe making some short-term decisions that are having a long-term negative repercussions. So if you could kind of just unpack that, just tease that a little bit for the audience, what you mean by follicular health and the things maybe that they could think about doing as a takeaway.
Absolutely. So the I think the I call it the classic model of ovarian aging. So, and this is really close to that conversation on perimenopause and menopause. I mean, it's the underbelly of it. It just doesn't always get talked about. So classically, what's been the idea is that as women age biologically, there is a quantity of follicles that get reduced. And that was always the idea that, hey, as you age, your eggs in your
You run out of eggs.
begin, exactly, you run out of eggs. And once you run out, oh well, you're that's it. And that is going to, as a result.
And that starts in the in as an embryo, right? Like your eggs are
Absolutely.
determined as when you're an embryo. Yeah. And there's nothing you can do
Absolutely.
about it.
And the common belief was always that you were born with a set number of eggs, and once they're done, they're done. And that as a result, because the follicle is a huge source of, and this is the old model, estradiol, E2, that you're going to not make estradiol anymore, and you're also going to reduce your capacity to have be fertile. So your fertility also goes down. And this was always associated with biological age. Now, the new model is quite different. So it says that yes, quantity of follicles is important, but what's even more important is the quality of
Quality.
follicles, that you can have all the follicles, but if they're not quality, you will not be able to make adequate ratios of androgens, estrogens, and progesterone, as well as you will have an altered steroid hormone environment within your body, and you're going to have reduced fertility, reduced health, and overall well-being. And that this can happen at any age if put in the right environment, that it's not something that we're directly associating with biological age or chronological age. And this is a really, really important distinction, because when
How
we
new is
make
this?
this,
How
I
new
would
is
say
it?
the last 10 years or so, and I would say it's not fully like this is really cutting edge. This is
The
still,
first time I've heard this idea. I
This is,
clearly remember, like you get your eggs, you're born with them. That's it. I went to a fertility clinic back in my mid-40s, and that's the story they told me. So this is fascinating.
So what's really interesting is I think we're getting more of this awareness, because when women go on, especially like contraceptives, or if they have, let's say, for example, hyperandrogenism, polycystic ovarian syndrome, what was started to be seen is that levels of quantity would remain high into women's 40s and even into their 50s. So they would have what's called anti-Müllerian hormone levels, which is your level of quantity, and it would be shown to be very high of eggs. But when they started to look at the quality of eggs, they saw that it was not conducive to making healthy hormonal milieus, the environment. And what's the most kind of like, I'm always about like, let's strip it back, try to strip it back to the lowest denominator. And so what are we actually looking at is we're seeing that the follicles, the littlest tiny units, and we start to look at what are the cell behavior and environment within those little follicles, that they are incredibly vulnerable to physiological stress. And so if we put our bodies under physiological stress, such as poor diet and exercise, low or high calories, certain types of environmental kind of pathogens or different types of endocrine disrupting chemicals, all the way to just stress, psychological stress, that our follicle quality begins to reduce. And when we reduce that, we run into problems. And you know, one of the important things is that we know, I mean, we're so depressing when I say this, but we're all dying. All our cells are turning over right now as we sit here
No
or
one
as
gets
we
out
walk
alive,
and
right?
listen.
No one gets out
Exactly.
alive.
So exactly. And so our cells are constantly dying, and they're sometimes we're able to
Generating.
turn or regenerate, and other times we regenerate, but not fully. And then other times we're just always getting bombarded by like aging, cellular aging. And so we know with the follicles that we are supposed to have cellular aging and breakdown. That's totally normal. But what we're seeing is an exasperated and expedited cellular aging at the follicles. And as a result, women are going into perimenopause earlier, that their quality of eggs are reduced, and that has consequences for long-term health. It has consequences for even how we should approach hormone therapies, because it doesn't necessarily mean that their eggs are unable to ever make hormones again. It just means that, you know, in that moment, they're not as fruitful. You know, if we think about certain types of physiological kind of like hallmarks. So, for example, you see epigenetic alterations happening. You see a loss of DNA. You see some intracellular communication in those eggs. All of that is starting at that very crux. But what that means is that that individual now has higher inflammation in their follicles. They have higher oxidative damage. They have reduced mitochondrial function. And so that is what I started to realize about 5 years ago, we could begin to work on, that we could begin to implement certain things to actually help with follicle health. And as a result, I mean, I have helped women get pregnant into their late 40s, not a problem. I'm not saying that this is everybody that can do this. However, when we focus on the follicles and trying to create the healthiest follicles possible, that's our lowest denominator of reproductive aging. And I always try to think about, okay, what's my lowest and then what's my biggest? Because I want to be able to see the full picture of somebody. And then that also allows for, I think, just a lot safer interventions as well when we really try to cover all of our bases along the way.
So then what would be some things that somebody could do to, number one, figure out what the state of their follicular, health is, and number two, what could they do to improve?
The cool thing about a lot of the stuff that I talk about for implementing hormone therapies safer are also things that are generally speaking going to make you healthier. Because we know that
I was thinking that.
the
It's like gut
healthiest bodies.
health, antidepressive, states, muscle hypertrophy. They all kind of sound like the very similar protocols.
Absolutely. Because if our foundations are in place, that means our cellular foundations are in place, that our cells have what they need. Our genes are in a better environment, even if we do have certain types of risk factors. It means that then our signaling is proper, and just the reactivity within our bodies is at a more baseline state. And so, you know, the how can we prevent premature ovarian aging? Eating sufficiently with high micronutrient status. We're not having a caloric massive deficit, but we're also not having a hypercaloric state. We are eating for us.
Maintaining a healthy, like BMI or healthy, body
Body
composition.
energy. We're working on our mental health. We're making sure we're getting adequate sleep. We're reducing endocrine disrupting chemical exposure when possible. We are managing any type of pharmaceutical drugs that may need to be used for other issues. We're just working on like all cause stress. We're also, though, managing our mitochondrial health. I think mitochondrial health is such a cool world.
You're going to have to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so mitochondria, they are the, I mean, I learned this back in my undergrad, but they are the powerhouse of our bodies. They are the little energy making machines. And that as we age, our mitochondria not only are undergoing a lot more stress because of just biological aging, but they're also often don't have the tools they need to be healthy. And what they need to be healthy are things that are going to reduce inflammation, reduce oxidative damage. So, and oxidative damage, our opposite of that is antioxidants. So basic micronutrients, vitamin A and C and D and E, things such as ubiquinol, which is a form of coenzyme Q10, urothiol A, ALA. So some very basic micronutrients can have a profound effect on cellular aging. For example, L-carnitine, which is a very basic mitochondrial agent, is being used within actual clinical research for individuals to promote menstrual cycle restoration after periods of amenorrhea.
Wow, I didn't know that. And is this like, is this serum L-carnitine, like injectable L-carnitine, or is it oral?
L-carnitine, they've used oral as well, but there are some, you know, some nuances there, which is the better option to go. But one of the things that they realize is that, you know, prolonged deprived states, so food deprivation, caloric deprivation, your body will maladapt to try to make energy from alternate pathways because you're not giving it what it needs. And they were seeing in individuals that their actual way that they were tr their mitochondria were trying to make these energies were maladaptive, and as a result, their follicles were never getting better, that they were not able to go through the normative kind of follicle process. So they started doing this research, and it's fascinating because they did see that together with therapy, that they could get spontaneous recovery without using hormones.
That's fascinating because in my job, especially in the athlete stream of things, we do see that happening with people. And the doctors always want them to, they always say, well, they need more body fat. And I'm like, I would understand if it was a super lean, ab veins kind of a gal, but a lot of times it's not. It's just a gal that she just, some gals they'll just pick up a dumbbell, it seems. We may maybe drop calories 200, and all of a sudden they just lose their period. And of course the doctor wants them to gain a bunch of body fat, and they want to put them on a like progesterone or something like that. And so that's interesting that we're looking at maybe some alternative therapies to support, a healthy reproductive cycle.
Absolutely. And we know that the body is inundated with stressors over a life course. The longer we're on this planet, the more we get exposed. And I think that's a really important lesson that a lot of people I work with forget, that we are simply by being on this planet and engaging in life, we are open to more stressors, whether it's the sun, which is it can be a eustress, it can be a positive stress, or physical activity. There's still stressors to our bodies. And that as a result, that has kind of this combined effect over time. It's kind of like having a credit card with in your 20s, you kind of had this no spending limit. And as you age and you have more expenses, kids and house and all this other stuff, your limit is reduced. But a lot of times I see people that are trying to still spend like they did in their 20s, in their 40s. And when they
Oh, I like
can't,
that you're making that analogy.
when they can't, they chalk it up to, oh, it must be my hormones. And I don't want to say that it's not, because it's still important. It's very important. However, if you have one quarter of the credit card limit you had in your 20s, and you're still trying to buy luxury goods all day, every day, you're going to run into bankruptcy. And that simply slapping hormones on it can sometimes result in almost like taking out another credit card and then just putting yourself more and more into debt rather than getting to the crux of it and going, okay, how can I optimize my spending better? How can I make sure that I'm constantly renewing and nourishing and replenishing? And yes, having hormone environment that's not quote optimal is going to expedite your spending, but it's not the only thing that we need to be paying attention to. It's one of many things. And I truly believe that when we hyperfixate on steroid hormones, whether that's androgens, estrogens, or progesterone, we fail to look at everything else in the body. We absolutely fail to look at all of the things that come before hormones and come after hormones. And as a result, that's what gets people into problems. Obviously, being prescribed the wrong drugs, that's very problematic in its practicing that we still see today. But even with the ones that are, quote, better or good for you, like bioidenticals, they still have to be put in the right environment to thrive and to be able to be done safely. And the hardest thing I see, Michelle, is that people don't recognize that this has to change over time. We're not going to stay on the same workout forever and expect the same gains forever. We have to adapt and react as our needs change. And that's the same
Love
thing with
that.
hormones.
Yeah. So, takeaways here, right, for our audience are this idea that as you're going through biological age, make sure that you're doing all the things to secure reproductive aging. And if you're just listening to this and you're realizing, oops, I've been dieting forever. I never take recovery days. I never do deloads. I totally don't manage my sleep, and all of these things, that there's a lot that you can do now and to change that and have some urgency around that. And then there's also some supplements that you might be able to take. But this, of course, you're probably going to be, you're not going to want to guess at this, right? So work with somebody. Like, are you deficient in something? Could a supplement like L-carnitine help, or coenzyme Q10 or something like that? And in that case, Victoria, where would somebody go to figure this out? Because as you know, and I wanted to ask you about this, where is your stance on, getting your insurance to cover things, going through the public, medical system? How are you going to really get the kind of attention that you need? Because I know, again, like Dr. Serrano, I remember him talking about an interview about female hormonal health, and he was saying, when I get a new patient coming in, it can take me an hour to pull the information I need from her. And yet in the public system, I think doctors have now something like ridiculous, like 50 minutes, and that's it, right? And they're not encouraged to write prescriptions for tests and all that stuff. So I'd love to hear from you, like, are there some easy things that people can do to kind of move the needle so they're not listening to this and going, oh my God, it's so complicated, there's nothing I can do.
I almost finish every single lecture I give on this. I say, because the body is so complicated, what we have to do is relatively simple.
Ooh, I like that.
Basics, like that's what people miss, is they miss the fundamental basics. Now, I would say, and I don't like to generalize, but for most people, the basics have to be in place first. Now, with that said, we can graduate, we can go up the staircase, but not everybody has to go up the staircase. And if you don't have the basics, how can you ever know if you need to? And by going up the staircase, I mean advanced supplementation and advanced testing and advanced, hormone therapies and things like that. So put our basics, put our foundations in first place. And some of those things you mentioned, like proper strength training, but also proper recovery, proper sleep, taking care of our mental health, having positive social relationships and a sense of community. And these things often, especially within the world that I often educate in, which is the athletic world, people always poo-poo them. They're like, ah, that's not important. But no, actually, there's some really good research that's showing that this is absolutely hugely important for our brains. If we think about the most basic example I can give people is that we have what creates kind of our female endocrine system or our female reproductive system is the hypothalamus, the pituitary, and the ovary. Now, it's way more complicated than that, but if we just simplify it, it's HPO. Two of these are in our brain. One of them is in our uterine. I'm just going to call it complex. So if two of them are in our brain, that means we need to be taking care of upstairs more at times than we need to be taking care of downstairs.
And it's funny because if you go onto various sites like I don't know if you follow the Brain Docs, probably you already do. If you look at their prescription for diet, Gabrielle Fundero, she's got, gut health out and what her prescriptions are for health. Annie Smukherjee and her prescriptions for navigating menopause well. And these diets and lifestyle prescriptions, right? The sleep and the stress management and healthy social interaction and all those things, they're the exact same prescription. It's fascinating because I go and try to find something for a client, I'm suffering from this or that. And I'm like, what's the same? It's the diet is the same as the diet that I just, dispensed for somebody else for something different. It's the same diet.
Yeah. And that's the thing is it's the basics. It's the basics first. And sometimes the basics can be really hard to put into place, particularly if we're dealing with more advanced mental health concerns. And those mental health concerns can be exacerbated from low hormonal states. Estradiol is incredibly important for brain health. With that said, it is merely one piece of a much bigger puzzle. We know with some of the research on vasomotor symptoms that the low estrogenic state that's associated with them are more, we have to be more looking at catecholamines, which are stress hormones. We have to be more looking at these other systems because they're what is really being supercharged. And because we don't have the estradiol in place to help buffer us, we then get this outcome. And estradiol is just one component. Androgens are important there as well. So are progesterone. However, if we strip it down, it's that we are in a high stressed, highly charged state. And that has to get worked on first. And I would argue, even in and I work some very complex cases with clinics, that we still have to work on that first. Because if we then just put hormones in the mix, it often creates more detrimental outcomes, at least initially, because their body is in such a highly, it's in such a highly excited state. I always say it's like your nervous system's on fire. You got to calm it down first, because if not, then you're going to become reactive to even good things, even positive things that we know can be very, very beneficial. But that poor amygdala in your higher brain center is going run, run, run. And so we have to just kind of, again, strip it down to the basics. Now, going back to your question, like, what can we do? And I have to empathize and sympathize. I mean, I've been in it. I have been in the Canadian medical system, of all medical systems, and trying to navigate it as a young female athlete. And even as a, in my 30s, trying to navigate it before I moved, it's still incredibly challenging, even for me as a researcher in this world. It does not get easier unless you create allies. And so allies can come from, many different ways we can kind of get to that point. But I think the first thing we need to do is, number one, recognize that the system is not working for us, it's working against us. And I think if we can just, and it sounds so depressing when I say that, but I have to tell you, when I tell my my patients that, or the clinicians I work with that are also having to work with kind of integrated networks, it's just remembering that right from the get-go, it's always been about fixing the sick woman. It's always been about just kind of giving them drugs and shoving them out the door. And so the system, the doctor that you're talking to, isn't necessarily a bad person. They just haven't been educated properly. That the way in which the system has shaped,
and the system that they're in is also probably not conducive.
And it's not conducive. And so going in, I always say, like, prepare for the worst, plan for the best.
So go in educated.
But we have to prepare for the worst. We have to go in, having our own health timeline accomplished, knowing that, hey, here is my file, and make it simple. This is for women. This is when I've had my children. This is the type of menstrual cycle I had before I started to go through perimenopause.
So really be clear about your hormonal health.
Really write it down. This is what I'm experiencing. This is when it started. And then having questions and having prioritized and like one, and even if you only get an opportunity to ask one question, that's the one you need to target first. And then the secondary ones come after, because sometimes they say to you, you only have 15 minutes, you have one appointment, and you're only allowed to ask one question. So go in armed, go in prepared, because you are your consumer of health. So you really need to kind of help the system out. And it doesn't work for all doctors. And I'm going to be completely transparent in that. Some doctors can, I've been in appointments actually where they've taken offense to it, which is sad. And if so, I would recommend getting a re-referral.
They call you a Google warrior, right? You've been Googling or talking to,
And that's where I say, like, I don't tell people to say that they've been researching anything. Come in with your data.
Yeah,
Because
exactly.
your data can't be refuted. It's you. You are the patient. And as an
That's a great
individual
point.
within our system, it's important to remember too, especially depending on what country people are in, is that there are insurance is a really big part of the battle, because there are certain types of testing that insurance companies quite frankly don't want to pay. So even offering to pay out of pocket if available is a great option. And even with you're within the Canadian medical system, you can still pay out of pocket. A lot of people don't realize that. But if there's a test that you want and you have a doctor that's willing, even if it's a general practitioner, to put it on your life labs form, but your insurance won't cover it, you are allowed to pay for it, which is really important because naturopaths in Canada, at least, depending on what province you're in, they can order lab work for you through Life Labs or DynaCare or any of those other organizations, but you
This
have
is
to do it out of
important.
pocket.
I know a lot of times I'll hear clients say, "Oh, but I can't get an MRI or something until next year in Canada." And I think, "Well, but I know 'cause my husband had to get an MRI and he just paid out of pocket for it. He got it like the next day."
And that's the fascinating thing. If you actually go to Life Labs, if you're a Canadian listening, go to Life Labs. You can click on the pay for fee service page, depending on what province you're in. That's a hugely important thing to recognize. If you're by the border, don't be afraid to cross the border and order through Quest or Alta Labs directly. You can do that. You are allowed to do that. There's nobody that's going to prevent you from doing that. But again, these are all things that you have to have money for. And that's the sad reality of it. I wish I had easy answers for people, and I don't. What I can tell you is do your homework. Look, if you want a referral to, let's say, a gynecologist, search for somebody before you ask. So going on like RateMD or My Doctor Rates or any of that type, even Google has ratings, go on and start to read people that you might want to ask for a referral for ahead of time. Don't just leave it up
To the
to
doctor,
your doctor,
to your
because
GP,
often they'll just put it in this like random system and bring up somebody who may not be a good fit for you. Often I
That's
find that
great.
with
I love that.
gynecologies, specifically kind of like that gynecologist, you want to find somebody that has what you want, the expertise. So if they're a gynecologist and they're also very involved with still delivering babies, that's probably going to be their scope and that focus, because it's going to be more on delivery rather than, let's say, reproductive aging. So if you can do some of detective work before you go into that appointment and ask for that referral, we're already getting the ball going in the right direction. Now it's not always going to end well. I have to be honest, but if we can put the feelers out ahead of time, if we can also ask questions and try to have a conversation with our practitioners, I always recommend that people also bring somebody with you, because it can be incredibly emotionally exhausting to be in a medical appointment by yourself, and then you forget half the things you wanted to say because you can't be the patient and the advocate at the same time. So I do recommend people bring a friend, a sibling, a partner, whomever it is, that they've got your questions with them, so that we can make sure we get them answered. Other things that are really important too is that regular assessments. And so, pap smears and mammograms and other types of even pelvic ultrasounds, you are entitled to them as individuals, as women with bodies that are aging, that are complex. You have to often ask for them. And if you're told no, keep asking.
Asking, okay.
Keep asking. So, for example, a great example is actually one of my own. It's within my own family. So my mom had triple negative breast cancer. And in the Canadian medical system, triple negative breast cancer do not qualify. Their kin, their daughters, do not qualify for early mammograms and ultrasounds. That's old research. So we now know that it is a heredity, there is a hereditary component. And so what I did for my sisters is I armed them with, here's the research. here is the Research Institute link. Printed them off, take them to your doctor, and go as far as the cancer agency. Because if you actually go into cancer agency, it says self-select for mammograms. Doesn't mean if your doctor says no, you can
You can
self-select in
bypass
my
them.
cancer agencies. So there's these, you've got to be thrifty, you've got to be savvy. And it can be actually fun if you recognize that the system you're working in is kind of against you. You just go into it knowing that. I find a lot of that
Currently,
anxiety.
hopefully it
Yeah.
will shift.
Yeah, it can go away. I don't like to say that, like, just go find a doctor and pay for it. You know, I don't think that's a responsible thing to say to people. If they can, awesome. But if it comes down to say, hey, I'm going to pay for this $2,000 worth of lab work, but now I can't afford the medications and the supplements that could be life-saving for me, that's a terrible place to be in. An absolutely terrible place. So try to work within the system until you can't anymore. Whether it's because you've tapped out resources or emotionally you're tapped out. But honestly, Michelle, I truly think that we have to go into it knowing that we're not working in a system that's going to be working for us. So just remember that.
I mean, that's so incredibly important. And I know we've been already talking for 50 minutes here, but I do want to touch on one last thing
Absolutely.
before we say goodbye. And that is what we're seeing now. And of course you're seeing a lot of it. I'm seeing a lot of it with, so now we have this conversation going amongst the female population, we don't have to experience aging the way maybe our mothers did. We can experience something better. What to do about it? And there's a lot of conversation about hormones, right? And outside of lifestyle, I mean, my clients generally are, dotting the I's and crossing the T's. Maybe they could do a little bit better with like managing stress, so saying no to certain things and saying yes to other things. But a lot of times, it's like they're doing all the things right, right? So then. We go to the doctors, we ask for, we start the journey around HRT. And then what we're seeing though is all kinds of weird and wacky recommendations. And I have clients all over the world. So I'm seeing, testosterone being used for weird things. I'm seeing prescriptions of birth control for menopause management. I mean, all kinds of things. And it's, I would say, I want to say it's rare, but let's say 50-50 that the prescriptions actually bring about a positive result. A lot of the gals, some of them are listening right now, have tried like three or four times, right? They're trying to resolve their sleep is a big issue. Sleep and vasomotor problems, and sometimes independent, like they're not having hot flashes, but they're having or night sweats, but they're getting up at 3, this magical number, 2:30, 3 o'clock. I've got like half my clients that are in that age can't get back to sleep, and of course that is a huge issue with everything else. I mean, if you don't sleep, I can't imagine. I fall asleep like a baby. I'm super healthy, so lucky. I can go up and go pee. I fall right back to sleep like a teenage guy. I don't have a problem. I used to have problems. I have no idea why I don't have problems anymore. I haven't for the last 10 years. So I really empathize with these gals. What do they do, right? Because they feel like they need some kind of support, but can you feel safe? And what do you do as a non-expert?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's one that challenges, at least I know myself and many of the other practitioners that I work with, because you want to be able to support the symptom, and you want to be able to give symptom relief. And we know that supporting symptoms is more than just like making somebody feel good. That the symptom is happening for a reason. It's often the endpoint of a very complex chain of reactions that have taken place, sometimes short term and sometimes long term. So I think the first thing I always say is let's work on the foundations first. You know, sleep, for example. There are so many different lifestyle things that we need to set in place first. And then we can go up that step and go, okay, is there any supplements that I can utilize to help me that are over the counter and that there's some solid research supporting? So for example, even something like melatonin can be incredibly useful when used appropriately and with the right synergy of other products in place. It's not going to be a miracle, but nothing is going to be a miracle. No matter what people on social media say or books or whatever, no one thing is the answer. That body is simply far too complicated for that. And then, if we've maximized that, let's say we've added in melatonin, we've got P5P, and maybe we've got some taurine in there, and our room is the proper temperature, and we've done all this, and we're still challenged. Then we need to go up that step. And that next part for me is looking at, okay, am I still making adequate hormones? Yes or no? If I don't know, I need to find out first before I throw drugs in the mix.
Okay, this is important, everyone. So I'm going to get Victoria to repeat that again. The next step is figuring out your actual.
Yeah, hormones. Yeah. So, am I making hormones? Am I making adequate hormones? That's
So this
probably
is
where
like
you're
your
referring to.
follicular, your reproductive age.
Absolutely. And
Okay.
not only that, it's also your adrenal. So, as women, if we think about, so our how we make steroids is very complicated. We're not very complicated, and it's not just about levels. It's also about our receptors, their
Receptors.
sensitivity. It's incredibly complicated. So when you go and you get levels checked, that's only one small part of this much bigger picture. And that again is where people can run into to challenges if we're just looking at levels. So what I recommend is that it's one of many pieces of data. We look at how somebody's where they are in reproductive aging. So we start asking questions about, okay, when did you first start to experience issues with sleeping? Have you had vasomotor? If so, when did they experience? Are you still experiencing? Are they more severe? When was your last regular menstrual cycle? Not just are you still bleeding or not? Like, when did you start to notice more clotting or heaviness or oh my gosh, I can't say that word. Irregular menstrual cycles. There we go. And are you ovulating? And if you're not having any bleed, okay, why? When did you stop having a bleed? Do you still have your ovaries? Do you still have your uterus? Have you had an ablation? We have to dig deeper
I love that you're
for.
saying this because it shows how passionate you are about being very pro female health. And what I mean by that is like a real respect for the entirety of what it is to be female. I think, and I know that that's how I was raised. I was born in the 1970s. There's that we don't talk about it. Right. And most of my clients, I mean, even though we clobber them with get on some kind of a cycle tracker and a symptom tracker right from the get-go, there's a lot of reticence about that and people relying on their memories, which is a terrible thing to do, especially with your cycle, if you're already prone to ignore everything. Right. So this is so key, it's so huge. And if you are younger, please get on tracking this stuff because it is so important for when you do hit perimenopause. Sorry, I didn't want to interrupt, but I
Yeah,
love that you're
no,
saying this.
absolutely. Because there's also other things. Like I think when we think about like reproductive aging in women, it's automatically like, are you bleeding? Yes or no. Are you having hot flashes? Yes or no. And are you having sleep issues? Yes or no. And then it's like, that's it. Where
Yeah,
there's
totally.
other really important things. So like one of the things that I experience a lot with women is that they'll come to me and they'll be like, well, I'm not experiencing hot flashes, but I got diagnosed with transient rosacea. And I'm like, oh my goodness, this is hot flushes. This is called flushing. And this is a vasomotor symptom. This is not rosacea. Throwing topical steroids is not going to help this. Like,
Oh,
this
wow.
is a
Okay. This is
part
new
of
for
the
me.
aging process. For
Gotcha.
some women, not for all women, but for some
So the
women.
changes in skin, sometimes it might be
Absolutely.
okay,
It's
great.
changing. I know myself, we can talk about my crazy hormones another day, but I know when I started to go through it's called premature ovarian failure. So essentially my follicles were not healthy and I wasn't making proper hormones, but I started to notice that my ears would go bright red if I was stressed, or then my nose would go bright red, and then my cheeks would go bright red. It was a flush. And I want it started happening when I was training, and I was going like, this is really odd. I'm like, I feel like this is the start of vasomotor symptoms. And then of course did some more testing, and yes, it was, but it's when your body gets stressed. So those catecholamines go up, and then you don't have the proper support. And it can be with vasodilation, it can be with vasoconstriction, there can be other things involved. But the more flushing we get, then we get broken blood vessels. And then we
Gotcha.
get the rosy cheeks that stay around. That is a sign of something else happening. We can't just take what's happening on the surface and
You've got
only
to
focus
dig.
on that. Just like having increased urinary tract infections or yeast infections or bacterial vaginosis, dryness, pelvic floor dysfunction in terms of that you are noticing you cannot hold your bladder, you're peeing all the time, or maybe you're having trickles of pee as well. I mean, pelvic floor is a whole nother thing, but it is such an important tool to learn more about because it gives us clues into our reproductive aging. It tells us about our androgen levels in our vaginal tissues. It tells us about our estrogens in our vaginal tissues. And this is part of that bigger picture. Joint pains, weight changes, appetite changes, that insatiable hunger that just nothing can touch. That often can be a sign of insulin dysfunction in terms of that you are not having proper estradiol to help create this harmonious response to blood glucose changes. We are often less sensitive to insulin, and therefore we no amount of food is going to touch us because we are so high with this insulin level. So these are all cues, changes to hair and hair loss, general shifts in just kind of affect and mood, but we can't take just one of these. This is the big problem I see is that people take just one of them and they try to treat just one of them rather than looking at the person as a whole and asking them the gauntlet of questions to then be able to actually develop a proper personalized approach to their hormone therapy if they need it. Because there are different individuals that they may have, let's say, a family risk of high breast cancer rates. And because we still don't fully understand the research around progesterone and estrogens and androgens in the breast tissue, I mean, honestly, this literature is growing at a faster rate than I can keep my finger in.
I
But
know, I know. And people
it's
talk about it like
amazing.
it's a sure thing and it's studied and it's
No,
done and
it's
dusted
not
and
at
it's
all.
not. And
No, nothing,
it's
nothing in science is
scary.
perfect.
Yeah, it's what's
Not
going on right now is
anything.
so scary.
Science is always changing. It's dynamic. It is only somebody's calculated opinion. That is all science is. It is not gospel. It is not God. It is not any of that stuff. It is somebody's opinion at the end of the day. And even if we're using certain types of research methods, it's still somebody decided to use those methods. It's still somebody's opinion. And when it comes to the research on hormone therapies, there's so much, I mean, just noise surrounding it because when women are being put on them and women are being tested, they've already lived that life. That they're not coming in as blank slates. And so it's important to look at you as an individual. Do you have breast cancer in your family? Yes or no? Or ovarian cancers or gynecological cancers, cancers that we know can be very closely related to androgen receptors, estrogen receptors, or progesterone receptors. And if it's even a maybe, that needs to direct efforts a different way than if we can say a clear cut no. Did you develop breast
And don't take that
cancer
lightly. I
at a
mean,
young
don't
age?
take that lightly. It's
No,
a you do
absolutely.
not want that diagnosis.
No, do you have hard breasts? Do you have a hard time getting a mammogram? Do you have incredibly dense breasts? Because if so, again, that's going to direct the therapy a different way. That might mean that we are not going to use systemic. We need to use more localized therapies that if you have vaginal dryness and increased risk of UTIs and pelvic floor dysfunction, that we might use a localized androgen, estrogen, estradiol specifically, or progesterone, not progesterone, but progesterone. There can be localized application and administration, even in women after they've gone through breast cancer treatment for hormone-mediated cancers. If they're estrogen positive, we know we can use things locally and have incredible benefit for long-term health because they can now have their sense of life back and they're not being inundated with antibiotics for things that don't actually need them and go on and from there. So hormone therapy can be incredibly tailored to the individual. And I
And
think it's
should
important for
be.
women to, yeah, and I think it's important for women to know that that's an option. It's not as simple as, hey, take a pill or have a patch or a pellet. No. There are so many different forms and routes of administration. There are so many different types. And in my opinion, I think, again, I'm not going to toot my own horn, but I think it makes sense. You start with the lowest dose possible and you try to see what you can do with that before we go up in dosing. And you go low and slow. You are constantly checking back with not only symptoms, but other types of lab work to be able to ensure that what we're doing is safe, what we're doing is effective, and it's doing what we need it to do.
Yeah, so one is the symptom, are the symptoms managed, and two, is it safe?
Yes, absolutely.
So constantly reanalyzing the risk.
Sometimes, Michelle, women don't get symptom reduction from the hormones that they're being put on because they're not doing any of the other things to help that hormone be is have as much positive impact as it should be. So I see women that have, let's say, mood swings and low libido, and they're just being thrown androgens and more androgens and more androgens because the libido is not coming from low androgens per se. It's coming from much bigger psychological and social factors involved. And while androgens can increase desire, they're not the only thing. And so if we just keep that like blinders on and we fail to look at this in a bigger picture, that's when we get into problems. That's when we're either not doing the proper assessment to begin with or the proper due diligence with actually mitigating symptoms from non-hormonal mechanisms or overuse of drugs and the wrong types. We have to have this more nuanced conversation. It's not an easy subject to discuss. It is a complicated one.
Okay, so let's just recap. So if you're doing everything right, or you feel you're doing everything right, and maybe that's going to take somebody else looking at everything that you're doing to make that assessment, right? Because what I always think, you know, when somebody says, oh, I train just like you, and I eat healthy foods just like you, and I think, well, I never walk into a gym. I just don't. Like if I see a gal that's training properly, I will go over to her and say, oh my God, you look serious, right? Because you just don't see that. And if I go to a restaurant, you know, I see all kinds of things. I rarely, you know, see another woman eating the way I would think she should be eating for, you know, her visual body composition, her age or whatever. So I'm like, I don't know if you're really... if our ideas of health and fitness are the same. So, but if you're doing all those things and you're thinking about the going up that next step, you're saying get a good snapshot of your, you know, reproductive age, right? Your actual hormonal functioning, that state. And then the next step would be to find a doctor, right? Or go to your, and you could do that using, what did you call it? Like not Yelp, but a way of assessing like a doctor's.
So it's like, there's like
right
Google,
doctor.
Reviews has it. And then there's like RateMD is another.
RateMD.
And then there's also like, I think it's like doctorratings.com or something.
And what about like the North American Menopause Society? Do they have a list of doctors that they can recommend that are educated?
I mean, it's hit and miss. SEMCOR is another really great resource. So SEMCOR is CEMCOR.ca, I believe, but it's the Center for Menstrual and Ovulatory Health. They have a hotline that physicians can actually call to talk to physicians and researchers that are well-versed in micro-progesterone use, that well-versed in transdermal estradiol use, and even topical androgen use. It's Dr. Geraldine Pryor's research institute. And so they actually have a doctor's hotline that you can, it's completely free.
Okay, so that's great to know.
Asking for, let's say, like one of my biggest pieces of advice is that we need to give the body what it actually needs, which means that we need to give it the forms of steroid hormones that it actually used to make rather than ones that it has no idea what these things are. And Dr. Pryor has been hugely, you know, influential in my thinking around this, that it's, we can greatly impact when we do it the right way. And that her center has this great educational resource for it. Because even I think when we think about like the North American Menopause Society or other types of physician organizations, you still don't really know what you're getting. It might be better. I don't know though. Like I've seen such a mixed bag over the years that I can't say that there's one that's better than another.
Okay. So do your due diligence, try to find, you know, do your research around your medical practitioner. If you have that option, if you're going to the doctor, go informed, right? So really know your own data. Can you talk at all about, you know, so you said, low and slow. So the lowest, I guess, dosage that is still, you know, clinical, and go slow in terms of, you know, making increases and in following symptoms. Would it be relevant for somebody, for women to be educated then, you know, like, you know, what is a low dosage of, say, progesterone, yeah. whether it's, you know, dosed daily or if it's cyclical? Yeah.
It's relative to them. And this is where it starts to get really complicated, because your, even your levels, even your serum levels are going to depict more than just, and it sounds so silly, but it's more than just like how much there is in your blood. It's how your tissues are, how your receptors, how you're binding them, how you're transporting them. I've worked with women over the years that their androgens and estrogens can be at the lower end of normal, but they feel great.
That's me. I have lower testosterone, and people think I've got tons of testosterone. My mom trained with Joan, same thing, because we measure ourselves regularly.
And sometimes it can be the tools that we're using to measure. So we know that, for example, androgen physiology is super complex. There's many different types. So sometimes it can just be a matter of like, what are we actually testing? But other times it can actually be like, hey, no, this is just their exposure over time. And this is what makes them tick. So it would not be useful to compare them to anybody else but themselves. And then also when we go through hormone therapy, to try to hyperinflate it, to try to get them on like that top end of optimal, that just doesn't make sense. And so we always have to look at like, who are we talking about? Who are we looking at? What is their levels? Because it's an individual that, let's say, is at the higher end of, let's say we have an individual and they've always had an ovulatory menstrual cycle. They had a super healthy relationship with their menstrual cycle over their life course. Steady Eddie, they always had this ovulatory cycle, which is rare in our society, especially with an athlete population. But they're going to feel the effects of not having progesterone when they go through reproductive aging, more so than somebody who potentially hasn't had that exposure, because they've been used to this thing. It's like having coffee every day from the time that you were 18 to 60, and then just being like, nope, no more coffee for you. Do life now. Like for some individuals, that can be incredibly challenging. And so we have to look at who are we dealing with? What has been their exposure, not just to their own innate hormone production, but also to exposure from other forces. For example, long-term oral contraceptive use, we know alters binding. We know it alters sex hormone binding globulin, potentially even at an epigenetic level, meaning that their levels of sex hormone binding globulin are going to stay inflated and high even long after they come off of it. And so these are really important things to know. And that's why I say, like, do your timeline. I mean, if you've been on a contraceptive pill from the time you were 18 to 32, and then you came off of it, and you've never had a regular cycle since then, write that down. That is very important data, because that means that you didn't ovulate during this critical period of your life. You didn't get proper exposure to progesterone. And this is going to change what you need. Even from like a bone health standpoint, hey, you haven't had progesterone production and exposure. Well, we know that your risk of osteoporosis has gone up now. And we can do something about that if we recognize that, if we can do this more tailored approach. So when it comes to actual drugs and doses and levels and even routes of administration, I think there's some basic premises I can share. So one of them I just said, so utilize what the body makes. So when we think about what is in this repertoire, it's, we have estradiol is going to be the main form of estrogen that gets given. There's also estriol and bias and trias, but we know that estradiol has the greatest efficacy. It's got the most amount of research on it. We also know that in order to reduce some potential negative risks of it, we want to use transdermal, whether that's with a cream or a patch, or you can use a little tiny tablet vaginally. There's also a ring that can be done vaginally, but those are going to give you more localized therapies, not systemic. The pill orally is going to increase our risk of, because it's getting metabolized through our liver. And so that's one that, generally speaking, doesn't get used often, or at least shouldn't get used often. Progesterone. So what's called oral micronized progesterone is the main form we want to kind of gravitate towards. Its trade name is Prometrium, and its dose is going to be dependent on our estradiol dose, or our actual innate estradiol production, because they're like yin and yang. And if we have too much progesterone, which I see this being done a lot right now, women going into HRT clinics and then being like, you need progesterone, and they're getting put on like 300 to 600 milligrams of oral micronized progesterone, you're going to be a zombie And your brain is not going to be happy with that because that's the top end of luteal phase that you're only looking for
Wow,
for a few
600. I've
days.
heard crazy
Yeah,
estrogen
no, yeah.
prescriptions.
So I've been seeing that because they're tired and they're fatigued, and physicians feeling like that's the solution. That's not all. It has to be balanced. We have to have a balance between those. And so we know that oral micronized progesterone will cross that blood-brain barrier. And there's very good research to show this. We know, though, that when somebody has not been exposed to it, I work at a really great clinic here in Michigan with a neuroendo psychiatrist, and we've been seeing this a lot, that when women have not seen it, had exposure to it for, like, let's say 5, 6 years, you have to go low to reintroduce it. And so we're getting we're splitting it in half, essentially. We're starting at 50 milligrams and then going up to 100, seeing where they're at 100 milligrams before we decide which kind of direction to go. We have to remember, as women, our hormones aren't flatlined. When we're in our reproductive kind of prime, we're up and down and all over the place. And so a lot of times HRT regimes are flatlining women. And sometimes that is beneficial. So I don't want to, beat around it. Sometimes that's what's needed. But if you're flatlining, you need to be at that lower end of dosing because you're getting a single level of hormone all the time. You must be at the lower end of dosing. And so 100
That's
milligrams
crucial. I'm
of
so glad you said that.
Prometrium is great for daily exposure. 200 milligrams or higher, we don't know what the repercussions of that is because that research has never been completed. So we have to be careful with that. And it is going to be relative to that person. And so that's why getting that testing done is really, really important. Cyclical use, so meaning like 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, 200 is a great starting place because you're only getting it for 2 weeks of the month, not every single day. And there are other forms of progesterone too. You can use vaginal, but it's going to be localized to the tissue. Transdermal, there's not enough research completed at this time to know if it's going to go beyond the capillary. And so I just recommend we stick to what we have, some good sound research. We don't have a lot of it, so we have to, like, stick to with what we have. And then when it comes to androgens, I mean, there are options for this. There are injectable forms, and then there also are transdermal forms. And I think it really does, in my experience, come down to the individual. Some people don't want to use injectable, and that is totally okay. There is going to be some differences between how topical and injectable work, but you need to figure that out for yourself. You have to figure out what's going to be best for you. Because when it comes to androgens, we simply don't know enough for me to feel comfortable going, like, everybody should do this, because we just don't know yet. So with androgens, though, we're typically looking at two different androgens. We're looking at DHEA, and then we're looking at testosterone. And these are androgens. Sometimes women are like, oh, that so sounds so scary having androgens. But no, we use a lot of them in our bodies. We need them, and they're very, very important. But just like we have to have androgen or estrogen, pardon me, and progesterone in check, we have to have androgens in check too. These things work serendipitously with each other. And so we have to make sure that we find what works for us and continue to revise and check. With testosterone, vaginal can be awesome for libido. You're increasing nitric oxide, you're getting more sensitivity, you're actually going to be able to have proper orgasms again. It can be awesome for that, but you're not using it all the time. You're only using it when you're wanting to engage in sexual pleasure, let's just say, or you're using it very low and local. So you're not going to be using it systemically. That's one route to go. Another route is to go low dose transdermal every single day. But if you do that, you then will need to change your estradiol dosing because there is a conversion factor there. So it is confusing. We're for my doctoral committee. This is part of the argument I have with them is all the time is that this is confusing. We can't just talk about it one way. Because it's not just one drug used in one way. We're talking about many drugs that can have many different outcomes in an individual. But those, for me, are the basics to start with. There's
That's
pregnenolone,
great.
there's other androgens, but just to keep it simple, DHEA and testosterone are our two primary androgens. We look at estradiol and then progesterone. And then we have different routes based off of different needs.
Beautiful. So, in summary, Where can women go to get some of this information written down in one place? Can you recommend a place?
I wish you could see my desk right now,
because Victoria's desk.
There really isn't one place right now. There are some great resources. Seamcore is a really great resource. They have a lot of really great information on their website.
Could you spell that one?
I'll send you the link for the show notes, but it's
okay, great.
CEMCOR.ca. So that is a really great resource. Then there is also some good information. I mean, Dr. Lara Bryden has a great text that's a very basic kind of entry. Do I agree with everything? No, but I agree with a lot of it. And I think that's the important thing to kind of get the conversation started. And then I also pulled this out because this is another really great resource. So it is dated. It's 2014, but it is got a really great way to start to walk through how to personalize HRT for you and the types of testing you need to do. And it's called a Practitioner's Toolkit for Managing the Menopause. And it published in the, I can send you the link for this, but it was published in 2014. And it's a nice basic entry into kind of some, and I hate algorithms, but it does provide some algorithms into like, if you have a uterus, here's the direction you need to go. If you
That's useful. That's very useful.
Yes. So again, not perfect, but it's a good place to start. And that's what we're looking for. This conversation, Michelle, is not going to be perfect. It's going to be complex. It's going to be controversial. There are going to be people butting heads, but there has always been that. It's not going to change as we get more knowledge. If anything, I think it's getting more complicated and more messy. And we have to have like truth seekers like yourself being able to guide women forward through it because it's a battlefield out there.
Yeah. So it's complicated. Take care of the big picture stuff that you can, like the lifestyle things. And there's lots of information, as we talked about, like on various modalities, what a great lifestyle is now that we know managing sleep and stress and healthy relationships and food and all that. If you're still having symptoms and you're doing everything that you possibly can, do your due diligence in procuring like great medical help. Be your own health advocate. Really understand, your reproductive of life cycle. Come with as much information as you can. Don't be afraid of a second opinion. There are some places that you can go and look for more information, like the CEMCOR, the SEMCOR, and the doctor again, Linda Phillips?
Lara Bryden.
I got that wrong. Yeah. Lara Bryden. So we'll share that link as well. And understand like low and slow is probably going to be your best bet. And I've heard this from many other doctors, like start with the lowest, clinical dosage and then titrate up depending on symptom management and then constant reassessment. So your doctor should be setting up some kind of a reassessment to continually evaluate, symptom management and risk factors as you age, and know your family history. And then this arena is just continuously evolving. So just staying up to date is also going to be really smart. It's not like a silver bullet is going to end everything. So just understand that, be patient and keep asking questions. And I think if people are interested to learn more about what you're doing, you're again on the bleeding edge of research. So they can find you at, www.victoriafelkar.com, and the same thing for Instagram. Are you posting a lot on Instagram? Have you taken a hiatus?
I will be though. So I made a pledge this weekend at the event I was just at that come this time next year, I will have my proper YouTube channel. I have no excuse. My husband is a media producer and a podcaster. So like I have no excuse other than I'm trying to finish like submitting the end of my PhD work. But then after that's done, this will be me full time. So there'll be a lot more of me to come.
Yeah. Cause we really need a strident voice from you in this arena because it's getting crazy and we need more women that are really in the research field and do respect that, that critical thought approach, getting out there and getting their message across, because people are just, they don't know what to think. And there's a lot of sort of like medical entrepreneurs, even doctors, but they're, you know, they're selling some things and they make it sound really black and white. And that if you're not doing X, Y, and Z, you're going to get dementia and your bones are going to fall apart and all of these things, even though we know lots of older women that are killing it and they didn't do any of those things because it didn't exist back then. So you've got to get out there. Thank you so much for spending so much time. This was so amazing, a lot of information. And I feel like we just literally scratched the surface. It's a big, complicated subject, but we can be more armed with knowledge.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
The Wonder Women podcast is proudly sponsored and produced by Social Fix. Social Fix is a transformational digital agency specializing in digital marketing, web design, social media, video, and podcast production for fitness, beauty, health, and wellness brands. Visit socialfix.com and request a free consultation for your brand's online image.